Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. We have lots to talk about today. And if you have a question for Dr. Sandy, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, 263-1890. Be glad to take questions about your pet's health or maybe your friend's pet's best health or, you know, whatever. Give us a call. Email us also at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
It is so nice to be back. Hey, are you getting bitten up by mosquitoes like I am?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had people coming in and they're so confused about heartworm preventative because they think that it works into the future. So they give a pill and they think it's giving them protection down the road. It works backwards, okay?
Oh.
So with all these mosquitoes out, life expectancy of the average mosquito is about 30 days, and we're having 80-degree weather here in Madison today. We've got a new bloom of mosquitoes out, you know, so keep on giving that heartworm preventative. In fact, American Heartworm Society is saying year-round probably isn't a bad idea for most dogs because it also controls intestinal parasites. So just keep that in mind. Use it, you know, at least through November, December, and maybe even year-round.
We have, is there another vaccine for dogs out there now?
Well, it's not a new vaccine. It's actually one that's been around for the last 27 years or so, parvo vaccine. But new guidelines for dogs that have been just recently published. And I've been a vet long enough that I've kind of seen these trends over, you know, the first of all, when I graduated, the vaccine wasn't even available. And that kind of is aging me a little bit. And I actually have a bumper sticker on my that I never put on my car. I just kept in my memorabilia box. It says, I've survived the parvo epidemic. Parvovirus causes severe diarrhea, vomiting, and death, especially in young dogs. And so it's something that we really have to protect them against. We used to recommend that vaccinations be given up until 12 weeks plus of age. We've now changed that to 14 to 16 weeks as the earliest age to quit giving it. What we're finding is that there's so many really good vaccines on the market now that mother dogs are being well vaccinated, producing good levels of immunity, passing that on to their puppies through the milk, what's called colostral immunity, getting antibodies through the milk. That is preventing the puppy from responding to those puppy vaccines until much later than we thought. So that former quit at 12 weeks of age, which was in our guidelines that were published a couple of years ago, has now been updated to say last one should be given 14 to 16 weeks of age, preferably that 4 months, 16 weeks of age.
Wow. And there's a new drug for cats out there that you're really excited about.
I am so excited about this because it is probably one of the most yuckiest, worst-tasting medications on the face of the earth. And you've tried pilling cats before, right? I know, because you've had cats.
Yes.
And it is
no fun.
You know, you have to have good health insurance, and it usually takes multiple attempts to do it. Well, in the past, when cats have had tapeworms, the only medication we could use was an oral medication. There was two of them. There's two of them on the market that work very well for cats. One of them now, this one called Praziquantel, is now available in a spot-on formula, just like the flea and tick preparations, but it just goes on the back, and so it's easy for those hard-to-pill cats. I have one of those at home that just hates being medicated. This gets roundworms, hookworms, and tapeworms. So for your cat that's out hunting, hopefully not, but if your cat's out hunting, catching mice, and eating them, good chance that they have tapeworms. And Center for Disease Control and the Veterinary Parasitology Group recommends that cats that are hunters be dewormed at least quarterly. So going every 3 months with a good broad-spectrum anthelmintic like this is really easy now. No more muss and fuss with trying to get pills down the cat. So
I love that idea.
I know.
1-800-642-1234, the number to call if you'd like to join in or in the Madison area. Reach us at 263-1890. And, you know, there's a new game out you were telling me about that I think is really cool.
You know, and I'm looking forward to getting it. And here I'm a veterinarian, and why should I want to be getting this game? But there is Nintendo DS, the double screen, you know. Anybody that has a kid that's my age probably has one in their house, and we have the little game called Pets, which is where you can adopt dogs, and it's very realistic, taking a training class. Well, they now have one out called Nintendo DS Paws and Claws Pet Vet Game. And you can become a veterinarian and treat a bunch of ailments. visits, and you have patients come in, you've got to buy inventory and drugs and so on, and you have to obtain loans to expand your practice, and you know, and I think it's going to be really good for consumers to, you know, maybe they start thinking twice when they come in and look at our bills that we present to them after they've had their pets treated, if they play this game a little bit and realize just, you know, there's a lot of business behind what goes on behind the scenes in the vet clinic, just running the place.
Well, I think it'd be a lot of fun. I don't know the age range on something like that, but it could be relatively young, I would think.
Yeah.
10, 12 years old,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, it could be.
And
you know, my daughter plays Sims, and if you don't feed the pets or do things, she has Sims Pets, which is another one of these, you know, new pet games, they'll die. And she came one time crying that, you know, her dog died because she neglected it. And I'm like, daughter of a veterinarian. You know?
Well, let's take some calls.
Okay.
Gary and Ephraim, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how are you folks?
Great.
Fine, thanks.
My question is, I've got a four-year-old Minton, and she is very active. She's kind of like a spring.
Oh, yeah, a little wind-up top. Yep.
There you go. Anyway, about a week ago, there was something that went very wrong with her, and I took her to my local vet, and he diagnosed the fact that she probably had injured one of the pads between her vertebrae.
Okay, one of the discs, yeah. Okay.
And so he gave her a cortisone shot and then has put her on a decreasing cortisone pill regime.
Mm-hmm.
And she's back to her old self and then some, but I've been trying to kind of control her jumps off my beds.
Oh, I know.
And looking towards the future, I understand that I may have to restrict her a little bit
right.
So this doesn't keep coming back, but that's kind of hard to do too. But is there anything else other than to just try to do the best job I can?
Can you tell me where they thought the disc was? Was in her neck or her lower back?
I think it's lower.
Lower back, okay.
Lower, where the spine comes into the hips or the tailbone.
Okay, down in the low end. Okay. The reason why I ask is if it was a neck injury, which can happen in small breed dogs very commonly, we recommend using a harness rather than a collar. Obviously, that's not going to help. But
no, she's always been in a harness. So.
Okay. As one that just injured her back this summer and had a bulging L4-5 disc after lifting a patient at work and then very stupidly going out and attempting to water ski. And I think if you've watched me,
that
it would have
been... That was Sandy, not me.
Yes. Wide World of Sports would have wanted that for, you know, like the crazy falls and stuff. But I know how much pain your dog could be in. And what I'm going through right now is a little physical therapy and learning some exercises. And I don't have a problem with weight, but that would be number one. If your dog is overweight, you got to get that weight off. Get your dog down to being a 4 out of 9 body condition score or a 5 out of 9, which means slender to normal. And so I don't know if your dog is a weight problem, but some min pins can look like little, you know,
butterballs.
I got pork roast on legs, I call them. So, yeah.
Well, she's certainly, when we got her, she was about 8 1/4 pounds, and she's probably about 10 1/2. Now.
Well, that would be like me putting on 50 pounds, okay? She's gained almost 25% of her body weight.
Okay.
So you need to make sure you get that off. That's even though it's only a couple of pounds on her body, that's a lot.
Okay.
So get her back down to her slim and trim weight. Your veterinarian can help you with either, coming up with her caloric needs, diets, if you need help with certain diets. There's even a new drug on the market now called Slentrol, which I've yet to dispense, but it's a drug for, you know, helping dogs with weight loss as well. That, you know, looks like it's a pretty promising drug. But I think with, you know, the right exercise, talk to your veterinarian about, you know, getting hooked up with somebody that does physical therapy. There's many places around popping up around the state. I don't know if there's anybody up in the Door County area, but I would bet over in Green Bay, Appleton, you may be able to find somebody. Even just a visit or two will show you some exercises you can do. She's small enough, you can even do water aerobics in your bathtub with her, and that's going to help strengthen her back and give her the exercise that she needs to lose the weight. But it can come back again, so you're right. You have to start training her that four on the floor is the way she's got to live. So she's not running up and down the stairs. You can carry her, walk her on a leash, keep her off the furniture if you can. You know, those are all
good things.
Big goals, but it can be done.
Good luck, Gary. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you so much.
Yes, appreciate it. And Ann, I believe, is next in Manitowoc. So let's go to Manitowoc. Hi, Ann. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the Bordetella vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
I have an 11-month-old dog who received his first Bordetella inoculation from the breeder at 4 months of old age. That would be like last November.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my previous dogs, I gave it to them once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now I was told that we have to do it every 6 months.
Okay.
So I boarded him this last weekend, and they said, oh, no, you need to have the Bordetella, and I thought he'd have been covered, but apparently not.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It is a little controversial. The nasal vaccine, which I assume that's what he got when he was 4 months of age, it may not provide a full year of protection. And so for dogs that are at high risk, meaning going into boarding kennels, show dogs, dogs like my dogs that have the pushed-in face and respiratory problems when they're just sitting there, young dogs, which is what your dog is, it's still relatively a puppy, mm-hmm. are more inclined to get the severe form of kennel cough. Rather than just getting tracheitis, they can have pneumonia and so on associated with it. So it's probably not a bad idea if it's been, you know, you're over 6 months and you're putting your dog in a boarding kennel to get it boosted again. But, you know, for your average household dog that's out on the street, maybe going to the dog park once in a while, very low risk, annual is probably fine. So I probably would have made the same recommendation for your dog.
Yeah, okay. Well, this past year he's a handful, so we, to give ourselves a break, would board him just overnight.
Okay.
it helped a lot.
Kind of like giving the kids to grandma,
well,
you know?
Yeah, but, you know, yeah. We need a break off. Let's put the dog in the kennel and go to a festival. So
okay,
that's
okay.
What we did. But so as he gets over a year old, should I just do it once a year or should I continue with 6 months? Or?
Sometimes it's going to depend on what the kennel you go to dictates. And I hate to have kennels dictate medical policy,
right.
But that's their prerogative, unfortunately.
Okay, yeah.
I would be recommending annual. If you don't want to do that, then find another kennel that will accept it being given annually.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And kennels remind me of spas and gourmet bakeries.
Oh, they're all over the place. I know.
Yeah, for dogs.
Yeah. And I don't do that with my dogs. They get, you know, they have their little kid's swimming pool that I got at Menards for, you know, $6 a couple of years ago. And that's their spa right there, you know. But, yeah, and I think what this is just showing you, the trend of where pets are going in society. They've become family members. And so we are giving them the same kind of things that we do for ourselves. But I haven't been to a spa in like eons. Maybe it's time, you know. But I'm still waiting for the human and dog. The dog goes down one way and the human goes down the other and you meet at the end. Wouldn't that be, you know?
That'd be the way to do it.
That would be. That would be. That would solve that lady's problem of, you know, having to board the dog. She could, you know, leave the dog at the spa while she gets a little relaxed. But yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's for people that have, you know, extra money and want to pamper their pets. And it's just the way society is putting pets in the, you know, out of the barnyard and into the bedroom. Yep.
Gail in Freedom, your turn. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a cat question. I have one of my cats is a 3-year-old tuxedo, and he can be laying on the back of the sofa, and then all of a sudden he does like this coughing, gagging thing. Doesn't throw up, but he does. It's like for 20 seconds, and then it seems like he's stops and he must swallow something and then he's happy.
Okay.
You know, he's been doing this. I can't say he does it every day or a specific time of the day. I try to watch that if there's a pattern, mm-hmm. if he does it in the spring or the fall.
Uh-huh.
I've never, you know, voiced my concern, you know, to his vet because I'm not sure I don't know if it's asthma or if there's allergies.
You're reading my mind. I have to ask you though, are you a smoker?
No.
No? Okay. But yeah, when we've got cats that have what you're describing, it's like a cough or a gag, few things come to mind. Cats are notorious for having asthma. It's a very common respiratory problem that cats will get. In fact, a lot of researchers use cats as the model for human asthmatics because I guess they have a very similar reaction. The way you would get a diagnosis is, number one, go in, have your veterinarian have a listen to the lungs, especially if your cat's having a bad spell for a week or so, then their lungs are going to be a little noisier. Getting an x-ray done, especially with, you know, if they take good x-ray films, you're able to see infiltrates around the airways, what are called donuts. That's a very scientific term that radiologists use, little donuts in the chest. And that's something that will often show up with asthma. Sometimes getting a tracheal wash, which has to be done under a light plane of anesthesia, will give you a better idea of what's going on. We'll sometimes see some cats with asthma have chronic infections as well. And it sounds like your cat is coughing some material up. So I think it'd be worthwhile getting that cat in to be looked at, get a chest x-ray. One other thing that comes to mind, though, but I would expect that your cat would have some voice changes and other things going on, is cats can get what are called nasal pharyngeal polyps. So get polyps in the back of their throat. They may get chronic ear infections associated with it because they'll sometimes grow out the eustachian tube. But you just may see kind of chronic upper respiratory problems or throat issues. And so when the cat's in to be examined, that may be something that they'll be doing too, is having a look at the back of the throat for something like that.
Yeah, because one thing he is he's a silent cat.
Okay.
I mean, he rarely meows.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's this little...
Yeah,
little squeaky noise.
And that may just be him. It may not be anything medically significant, but I think it's time to get him in and get him looked at, because asthma can get out of control very quickly. In fact, we used to have a number of blood donor cats at the veterinary school that were housed right off of our medicine ward, where it's staffed with technicians and vets and students. And these cats led a really good life. They ended up all getting adopted out, except for one who had asthma. It was missed because he would just do this rarely and no one ever caught it. Died acutely, and on autopsy found out that he had asthma. And here he was living right under our nose, and we missed it. So yeah, get him in to get him checked out.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Martinez White, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, we hope you'll join in. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can always email us at talk@wpr.org. Lynette in Hubertus is next. Hi, Lynette.
Good morning. I have a dog, and he just turned 1 year. And I took him in for his one-year checkup, and he had worms, hookworm and roundworm.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that diagnosis, he got all his shots.
Okay.
The rabies and the Bordetella and distemper. And then the following day is when the fecal sample came back positive.
Okay.
And put him on the Dronto.
Okay.
And he hasn't been quite acting the same.
Huh.
He's a little lethargic, not major, but he's just not as spunky as he usually is.
And when was he vaccinated? How long ago was that?
This was on Wednesday last week.
Wednesday of last week. Okay. All right. Yeah, I wouldn't expect a vaccination reaction. It's very common for pets for a day or two afterwards. If you've ever had a tetanus shot, your arm hurts and you may run a low-grade fever. I would expect that for a day or two. There are some very uncommon vaccination reactions that can cause immune-mediated diseases where blood cell counts may change. I'd call your veterinarian. They may want to take a quick peek at them and just make sure nothing's going on. Hookworms are a horrible parasite, though. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're something that it's a tiny, tiny parasite that lives in the small intestine. The reason why they're called hookworms is if you look at them under a dissecting microscope, they have very sharp teeth and a suction cup type mouth, and they glob onto the intestine, bite a hole in it, and suck blood. And dogs can become anemic and be very ill with this. The big concern that I have, though, is your health and safety. If your dog has been defecating out in your yard all summer with this hot, humid weather we've been having, that's hookworm heaven. And hookworms, their eggs, a stool that's in the ground that you've maybe left behind, you haven't picked it up religiously, can hatch, and the larvae come up and sit on grass blades, and you walk around your backyard in bare feet, the larvae can penetrate through your skin and cause a little eruption on your skin called cutaneous larval migraines. And we even know now that they can sometimes get past your skin and get into the intestinal tract and can set up some gastrointestinal problems as well.
Ooh.
So my recommendation is where your dog has been defecating, no kids play, okay, because they're down in their hands and knees, no bare feet, and they will die off come winter, thank goodness. And this is a good example of, was your dog on heartworm preventative?
Shamefully, no.
Okay. Heartworm preventative, all of them on the market prevent hookworms and roundworms. So keeping your dog on a heartworm preventative is going to help prevent your dog from getting these and transmitting them. That's why we do it, because of the public health risk. Your dog could probably not be happy, but could live with these parasites but we worry about public health significance of this. So talk to your veterinarian about long-term management, because you treat now, it's still warm out, your dog's going to go out and get reinfected out in your yard. So just because you're using the correct medication, this Drontel Plus, you still need to get your dog on something for long-term control and then start it up again in the spring, or preferably use heartworm control. And I should change, I want to change the way I say it. I've just been so into saying heartworm. Should call it internal parasite control, because it covers lots of different things.
Sure.
So talk to your vet about getting your puppy on, or your dog on that.
Thanks,
well,
Lynette.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
We did put him on the Interceptor.
Okay.
And I wanted to get your recommendation on running that year-round or just during the summer months here in Wisconsin.
We don't use it during just the summer months. Heartworm season here in Wisconsin is now, with knowing the life cycle of mosquitoes, getting that last dose in November or December. Because remember, that last pill is working backwards and protecting for October. So let's just hypothesize it's nice warm day today. New mosquitoes hatch. They survive for 30 days, okay? They can survive for 30 days. They're in your garage. They're protected. We may have a frost, but that means that 30 days from now, so mid-October, there still may be infected mosquitoes around that could bite your dog, which means getting a pill in November will eliminate what they got exposed to in October. It works backwards. And with your dog having GI parasites like this, we know your yard's contaminated. Roundworms can survive pretty much forever. Nothing kills it. You can rototill the top 6 inches of your soil over. You can burn it, pave it. But they're going to be there pretty much forever, the roundworm end. So your dog probably would benefit from year-round treatment.
Okay. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Sandy, we got an email from Josh from Phillips. I believe it was an email anyway. Says, I have a cat with 7 toes. Is it dangerous to cut one off?
Wow, I wonder why he wants to cut one off. He's got a polydactyly. Those are kind of cool cats. It's one of those kind of normal birth defects that we see with extra toes. I did have a cat in the other day with lots of extra toes, and some of those little extra toes are not developed fully, and so instead of having a nail that's functional, it was wrapped and it was growing right around and piercing the pad because the cat couldn't groom it, couldn't go up and flex their claws and get those husks off, and we ended up removing it because of the way it had injured and grown, and it just saved the cat a lot of trouble. So unless there's a medical reason for it, just keep them trimmed. You're going to have to help your cat a little bit, but shouldn't be a reason to remove them.
All right, on to Nate in Madison. Nate, hello to you.
Yes, Sandy, thank you for taking my call.
No problem.
This is a cat question. I got my cat about, maybe a year ago in Iowa. She was a stray. And this May, I'm not sure how old the cat is, but this May, she started cycling going into heat.
Mm-hmm.
And she did that about every 2 weeks for about a set of 6 or 7 times, and now she's stopped.
Is she pregnant?
No.
She didn't get out?
Nope.
Okay. That's normal cat heat cycle. Cats are what are called induced ovulators. And so instead of having a heat cycle like a dog does, and if they don't get bred, those eggs just get lost. Cats don't ovulate until they're mated. And so they will cycle in and out of heat every couple of weeks. It's very light and temperature dependent. if you're, well, light dependent, not temperature, but light dependent, and so it's very seasonal. My guess is that your cat was probably a younger female, and this may be her first heat cycle. Started in May, reached a certain size, age that Mother Nature said, whoop, now it's time to get pregnant. And that's what happens. And when the reason why I asked if she is not cycling is the number one reason for them to stop cycling, besides the season ending, which we can still see cats coming into heat even now, but it's starting to get towards the end of heat cycle, because, you know, if they got pregnant now, they'd be having their kittens in the middle of a snowstorm. That they get pregnant. So if she did get out, that, you know, maybe why she's not cycling anymore. Get her spayed. Now's the time to do it.
Well, that's the second question is, does that matter where she is in her cycle, or can you do that anytime?
We prefer to not have them in the height of a heat cycle because of the increased blood supply to the uterus, but good luck timing it on a cat. You set up the appointment, guaranteed she's going to be in heat. And a surgeon, I mean, I spayed lots of cats in heat and had absolutely no trouble at all with it. So a good surgeon will just throw an extra tie or two in there, and that's going to prevent a lot of headaches for you.
All right. Thanks, Nate. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Debbie in Whitewater. Debbie, hi.
Hi there. I have sort of a combination medical and behavior question.
Okay.
I am taking care of a 14-month-old Springer for a friend of mine. I'm trying to socialize the dog, and she is a bit of a submissive urinator.
Okay.
But my question is, I rarely see her urinate outside, and I don't mean to imply she's urinating in the house, but literally, if she goes outside once a day, you know, that's a lot. Now, I'm sure that sometimes when she's outside, my other dogs run up to her, she's letting a little bit of urine loose because, you know, she's
mm-hmm.
frightened.
Mm-hmm.
But I was wondering if there's a medical condition where they don't necessarily urinate a lot, or if she is just sort of not a very relaxed dog, and therefore, you know, her system isn't relaxed enough to go to the bathroom, and she only goes when she's really, really full.
And that may be all it is. I mean, I've seen dogs that have been so severely punished, they're afraid to go in front of people, and they will hold it and hold it and hold it until they have that opportunity to be able to go off unattended, which is, you know, sometimes when, you know, the owner's sleeping or whatever, they'll sneak off into a bedroom and go. But if you're not having accidents in the house, she may just have tremendous holding power. So, you know, no medical reasons that I could see, unless she's straining and having some problems that would prevent her from passing urine. But it sounds like she just is holding it and doesn't want to pass it. And it may be because when she's squatting, she's in a posture where she's a sitting duck for the other dogs to run up to her. Try to give her some alone time outside rather than with the dogs, and that may make her feel a little less stressed and nervous, and may allow her to empty her bladder with, you know, her in private. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're
Thanks,
welcome.
Deb. Jody, excuse me, in La Crosse. You're next. Hi, Jody.
Oh, good morning. This is Jody in La Crosse.
Morning.
Hi.
I've got a medical dilemma with three dogs that maybe you can give me some advice. The vets, we've been befuddled with this. Got a 12-year-old Golden, 10-year-old Brittany, and a 1-year-old Schnoodle.
Okay.
And since last spring, I believe it was the Brittany and the Golden did this first, they both got colitis, very severe colitis, and the Golden ended up being even hospitalized.
Wow.
Briefly, so we were pretty concerned about her, but she made it through. Second round happened about 6 weeks later, and I think that was the Golden and the Schnoodle.
Okay.
Then maybe 6 weeks again, I think the Brittany and the Golden had it. And then yesterday, I might have even all that confused, but they've been taking turns having colitis. Like one will get it, and days later another will get it.
It sounds like
and
it's
then
something.
Yesterday the Brittany got it.
Yeah.
I mean, she's got it again. I mean, she's got the diarrhea. She's got all the symptoms again.
Yeah. It sure sounds like it's something contagious. Yeah.
What is colitis, by the way?
Colitis. Okay. Inflammation of the colon. So how do you tell that from other sources of diarrhea? Those that are eating lunch, plug your ears or la, la, la. Okay, yeah, just maybe don't listen. Blood, mucus. The only place there's mucus glands is in the colon. So you'll see slimy stools, frank blood. If it's up higher, it gets digested, so the stool comes out dark and tarry. Usually small volumes. The dog goes out, strains to defecate, and is just pushing out small amounts of stool. It's something that's quite common. And in fact, the way I have teach students how to deal with colitis is I call it the five F's of treating colitis. And I hold my hand up, okay, the five F's, okay, because it's the fingers, okay. Number one, you'll want to do a fecal, okay. And I would be looking at doing fresh stool samples, so putting a finger there's number two, up the dog's rear end to feel if there's any getting fresh feces out of the colon. Have a feel to make sure that there's nothing up in there. With three dogs, it's very unlikely that it's a foreign body or a tumor. If it was just your 12-year-old Golden, I'd be concerned about something like that. But the fact that all three of them have got it tells me something that's going from dog to dog back and forth again. The reason why we check a stool sample is the two most common parasites that live in the colon are whipworms and another one called Giardia. And both of those can be really difficult to detect on a stool sample because they don't always shed with every stool sample. It's always worthwhile checking. Make sure your vet is doing the best stool evaluation method. It's called zinc sulfate centrifuge fecal evaluation. They have to spin it down in a centrifuge with a certain solution that gives you better egg yield, especially for Giardia. You'll see more Giardia cysts that way. The fecal that they get out, the feces that they get out on their glove too, they can do a direct fecal smear and a Giardia. There is actually a Giardia antigen test that you can run as well. Simple little test that most vets have in their clinic now. So get that done. So there's the first two Fs, fecal and finger. And remember I said they don't always show up on a stool check. So then we jump into treating. And all dogs with colitis, we throw on a round of what's called fenbendazole or Panacure. It's a dewormer, an anthelmintic that gets whipworms and Giardia very well. We treat for 5 days, usually 3 to 5 days. 2 weeks later, we treat them again, no matter what the stool sample showed us, because they don't always show up. The next drug we put them on is one called Flagyl. There's F number four, okay? Flagyl is also known as metronidazole, anti-inflammatory to the gut, and it will also to help treat Giardia, and it's antibacterial. And the last thing we do is we give the dog a special diet, and that's number five, food, okay? Mm-hmm. A low-residue diet, something that's going to give the colon a rest so there's not a lot of material going down there that's non-digestible. And my guess is that if you treated all three simultaneously like this, you may be able to get the problem under control.
Yeah, well, I think we've done all of those at different points. I mean, because I've put out a lot of money in terms of all those things and medications.
Yeah.
I mean, the Golden's been on three medications at a time, and that was just, she just got done with that, and now this one.
Yeah, yeah.
Today again. We just feel like it's going in cycles. We don't have an adventurous yard. We don't live on a farm. We go running in the marsh, but
yeah,
we can't figure out where this is cycling, and it's if anybody's experienced this, it's not fun for your if you have any.
It isn't. It isn't. And in fact, when you get groups like this, it becomes a real headache. So, you know, but I think it's time to, no matter, even if they're asymptomatic, consider if parasites are right up there on the top of our list, which it is for me, with these three having it, I'd be treating all three simultaneously.
At the same time. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, thanks a lot, Jody, for calling. And we finally have some open lines again. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Paul in Duluth, you are next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a wonderful 14-year-old pound puppy named Cassie, and she's a chow mix.
Okay.
And I took her into the vet, I guess it was at the end of May, to, you know, get her, you know, on heartworm medication.
Mm-hmm.
But she had been acting a little bit lethargic. So they did, I brought in a stool sample, and they did a routine blood panel. And they told me that she had been exposed to Lyme disease.
Okay.
So they put her on a course of antibiotics.
Uh-huh.
And she responded to that almost immediately. She perked up right away.
Mm-hmm.
But now what I'm wondering, she seems to be fine, but I'm wondering if you can give me some idea of what I might be looking for because of her age. In terms of, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't want to call it Alzheimer's.
Yeah, yeah.
Senility, but the only thing I've noticed that seems to be different is, well, I'm older too, and mm-hmm. we've both slowed down quite a bit. But she seems to want to just sniff when we go on walks.
Yeah.
And I mean, she's always wanted to sniff,
But now she's slowing down and enjoying the walk a little bit more, stopping to smell the daisies, huh? Yeah.
Well, she's, I call it pee mail.
Okay, right. There you go. Uh-huh.
But she's checking her pee mail.
Okay.
But is there anything else related to age that I should be looking for?
Oh, you know, I think you sound like a very observant owner. And the nice thing about our standard heartworm tests now, most clinics are doing a heartworm test that also includes Lyme, Ehrlichia, and Anaplasma, which are the big tick-borne diseases that dogs get exposed to. And so I assume that probably was what was done on your dog, and that's how they found out that she was Lyme positive. There is another test that you can do to follow up to show you, you know, just, you know, how bad the infection is. And I probably would have recommended, besides just doing a blood test, get a urine sample done as well, because that can pick up early changes in with kidney disease that can happen with older dogs as well that may not show up on the blood test. So I like to do both if I'm going to be going to the trouble of doing some screening in a senior patient, blood and urine simultaneously. You know, senility is something that can occur in dogs as they get older, and the symptoms that we'll usually see are failing to recognize you, losing some of their learned behaviors, having accidents in the house, change in their sleep-wake cycle. They're getting up and wandering at night. They may get stuck in a room and just stand there and bark with their head in a corner, not know where they are. They get lost. And it doesn't sound like, you know, Cassie's having any troubles with that.
Yeah, she doesn't do any of that.
Yeah, so it doesn't sound like she's running into the problems with doggy Alzheimer's or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But they do get arthritis, and so changing
she's
the way...
She's got a little bit of arthritis, yep. And she had surgery about, I guess about 12 years ago,
yeah,
for cruciate.
Okay.
But the arthritis, actually, the cruciate surgery was very successful.
Good, good.
And what seems to be happening is she's kind of, and it comes and goes, a little bit of a limp on her front legs.
Hey, I'm only 51, and if you saw me get out of my car this morning after driving in, I was limping a little bit too, you know, and it takes a minute to warm up getting across the parking lot. You know, if she has normal blood and urine, talk to your veterinarian about getting her on some pain medication, even just intermittently, to deal with her arthritis. That could improve her quality of life, and there's lots of nice drugs out there for dogs now, but you do have to do some screening to make sure that she's healthy before she can go on them. They're in the class called non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and that may make her feel a little bit better and give her a little better quality of life. Good luck with her. It sounds like she's a wonderful dog.
Thank you very much for calling, Paul. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234, Madison at 263-1890, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Randy from Lake Mills has an Akita that loves to lay in the mud and drink muddy water. Are there any parasites that she could acquire that could not be prevented by treatment?
Oh, well, this is a good one, because besides parasites, like Giardia likes water, that we've already talked about, that causing diarrhea, colitis, a lot of vague symptoms that way. The other problem that we'll run into is a bacteria called leptospirosis. Mm-hmm. It's spread through the urine of infected animals. And so she's drinking out of puddles like that. I'd be making sure that you talk to your veterinarian about getting her vaccinated for that particular disease. We don't vaccinate every dog with that, so it may not be part of your routine vaccination program. But if that's her lifestyle, even though she may not be a swimming dog, but more of a mud puddle dog, I think that may be indicated.
All right, on to Brian in Waterloo. Brian, hello to you.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my call. I have a 4.5 year old golden doodle who is, I think, on the higher end of the spectrum from a size perspective for that mix. But he's right around 90 pounds and has been a little heavier. But at his last annual checkup since then, this past spring, we've made this concerted effort to get his weight down.
Good for you. Yeah.
What's partially concerning me is that for about the past 9 months, if he's extremely active, we run through the woods or play a little too much chase or something like that, it'll almost appear as though when he's getting up from laying down, his hips are bothering him. And I don't know that much about hip problems other mm-hmm. than I know it can be an issue with big dogs. So I raised that when I brought him in for his checkup this past spring, and they said, well, they might notice that he seems to be favoring one of his hips a bit, but they said, you know, something just to keep an eye on, and, you know, for now start just focusing on controlling his weight and getting him some exercise. So my question is, I guess, for a dog this age and for that size, how unusual might that be? But also, what, if anything, could I do to minimize his symptoms or help prevent if there is a hip problem from getting worse?
Right. I just had a golden doodle in the other day that was like the size of your dog. As I looked at it, it's bigger than your average golden. It's much bigger than your average poodle. Where those genes came from, putting those two breeds together, I have no idea. But this dog was huge and hairy. The bigger the dog, the greater the chance for problems with hips. I would talk to your veterinarian about getting some x-rays done just to confirm that that's what's going on. Large breed dogs, the two things that I get worried about are either knee problems or hip problems. Mm-hmm. The most common knee problem we'll see is anterior cruciate partial tears or full ruptures. And then we do see in large dogs issues with their hips as well. And if your dog goes out and plays and then comes home and it's like, oh, I can't get up, and it's got to kind of warm into movement again, sure sounds like your dog's experiencing some arthritis. And kind of in general, the ways we deal with that are, number one, weight control. Get your dog down to a nice slender body condition to get the extra weight off the joints. Mm-hmm. Modify the exercise program to be more swimming, walking, rather than wild running and jarring those joints if you can help it. Talk to your veterinarian about some of the new joint diets that are on the market. There's a couple out, one by Hills called JD, one by Nestle Purina called JM. They contain various nutraceuticals, primarily glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate and antioxidants, that appear to be very helpful for dogs with joint problems. Depending on what the x-ray shows, if you've got a few extra thousand in your pocket, some of these dogs would benefit from total hip replacement. We like to put that off a little bit, you know, as long as we can, because they don't last forever and it's pretty expensive. But I have a number of patients that have had total hip replacements done, and that's given them great quality of life, just like they do with people that have bum hips. So you can, you know, do something like that if you wish. And I know that we do that at the vet school, and I know there's other board certified surgeons in the state that are able to do that as well. But
Can I ask a quick question? When his symptoms are acute, or I guess the most severe we see after a lot of activity, is there something that I could be giving him to...
Just like with the last caller that had the elderly dog that had problems with, limping and so on, and wanted to know if there's something we could do to improve quality of life because they were stiff. You can do the same thing. They are prescription drugs. Be really careful with the human over-the-counter medications. Ibuprofen and aspirin and so on can be very toxic to dogs unless it's used it's like aspirin we do use, but more risks with gastric ulceration, intestinal problems. Ibuprofen, therapeutic dose, very close to the toxic dose, so we just avoid it. Don't use Tylenol. There are some drugs that are safe for dog use, but before you put your dog on it, we always like to do some screening to make sure that your dog's able to tolerate it. So it's called an NSAID screen. We check liver, kidney function, get a urine sample if everything's okay. Rare intermittent use, I don't get too worried about it, but if you're looking at you're needing to use this daily to keep your dog functioning, then you better do some monitoring.
Yeah, okay. Very good.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Vern from Muscadet wonders about allergies. He has two terriers with skin allergies. What other breeds are less prone to this problem?
Oh, it's becoming a big issue for a lot of breeds. Golden Retrievers, by far, are probably one of the ones that the poster child for allergies. Labrador Retrievers get them. I think terriers in general tend to be very allergic dogs. We see a lot of the small, like the Cairn Terriers and Westies and so on, have a lot of issues with it. And to name a breed that doesn't have it, my bulldogs have allergies. Okay, one of them, not both, but one of them has a little bit of allergy problems right now, and his eyes get gooey and, his face gets itchy. So about one in five dogs will have seasonal allergies. It's a fairly common problem. problem. So it's more looking at genetics, and I'd be, you know, if you're wanting to not have a dog with allergies, check out what, you know, mom and dad's health have been like, and if they had issues with their skin or any problems that would lead you to be thinking that they have allergies. Remember, dogs, their allergy organ is their skin, and so you're going to see ears, feet, face rubbing with secondary infections. They typically don't get the respiratory signs that we do.
Good advice. Let's go to Wendy in Milwaukee, I think, is up next. Wendy, hi to you.
Hi, hello. I'm trying to get some information. We have a Jack Russell Terrier that we have tried to use a bark collar for and tried to use a variety of other things. I wanted to know your opinion on debarking a dog.
Well, it's not something that I have ever done, nor do I recommend it. It would be considered a very last resort. There's a couple of different ways that it can be done. There's one where they just open the mouth up under anesthesia and take chunks of the vocal cords out. Horrible way to do it. They can bleed. I've had I had a patient that actually referred to me that had aspirated a lot of blood after a surgery like this. They can grow back and can cause the dog's problems, or they can resume barking again. Remember, it doesn't totally remove their ability to bark. It just sounds like they have laryngitis. There's another way that they can go in and tie back the vocal cords, and then you run the risk of aspiration. They can aspirate food or things like that because they've lost that protective mechanism of having the vocal cords close over their airway. I don't know what kind of bark collars you've used. The one that I've had probably the most success with is the Citroen Vanilla bark collar. Have you tried one of those yet?
We lost her. We lost her.
Oh, we lost her. Okay. Well, the citronella bark collar is one that the dog wears. The bark triggers a spray of citronella. They feel it, see it, hear it, smell it. And it's just something that they don't like the smell of. And for many dogs, that works in about 80% of the cases. So it's worthwhile trying. Shock collars, you know, again, I just personally, I don't like using those. But if you get one that gives the dog a warning tone that kind of is like, okay, you keep barking, then you're going to get a shock. I think that's probably a little more humane than any other kind. But there are some that are out there that you can adjust the sensitivity and so on. And again, working with the behaviorist rather than just trying to deal with this on your own. There's lots of tips, especially if it's very, you know, specific situations that are triggers for your dog. They may be able to teach you some control methods to have your dog sitting and staying. It's really hard to get a good bark in when your fanny's on the ground. So, yeah. You know, some obedience training and some, you know, work with an applied animal behaviorist may be right in line.
Right, what you need.
Yep.
All right. John and Racine, your turn. Hi, John.
Hello. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Sure.
The problem that we have is we have an 8-year-old Welsh Terrier, and she's had a skin allergy problem. It's, you know, similar to what you were just talking about previously. And it's year-round. And to control it, we've been giving her Atopica.
Atopica, yeah. That's cyclosporine. Uh-huh.
And we've also been giving her Metrol, this steroid.
Okay.
Or Metrol.
Medrol. Medrol, yeah. Okay.
And also give her Benadryl. That's just to control all the scratching that she has. Otherwise, she'd scratch herself to death.
And you've had her checked and ruled out that she doesn't have a secondary yeast infection or a bacterial infection, because by far, that's the number one reason why dogs continue to scratch. I mean, you are treating her with everything that we have available. You know, we can treat with topical steroids in the ears and sprays. It sounds like you're using a systemic steroid, which I don't like to use long term. Cyclosporine is a big gun for controlling allergies. You know, so you're approaching it that way. You may be able to tweak the antihistamine with maybe one of the prescription ones like Allegra, fexofenadine that people take. We do use that in dogs. It's non-sedating. Whether it's going to be a little more effective, maybe not. But by far, the number one reason why they continue to scratch is because there's an underlying infection there that just isn't being controlled. So getting good skin scrapings and impression smears done of between the feet, the ears, and so on to look for those bugs, I think, is critical. And sometimes we even just treat to get to rule that out. The other thing is, since it's year-round, is consider food allergies as well. And if you've not had your dog on a hypoallergenic diet trial, I think it'd be worthwhile. And by that, I mean a hydrolyzed protein diet, something that the body is not going to recognize where the protein came from. She gets that and only that for at least 2 to 3 months. That's it. And even your heartworm preventative, if you're using some of the beef-based heartworm preventatives, you got to talk to your veterinarian about going to something different that is not going to be including beef, because that can be one of the allergens that dogs are allergic to. So I'd look into those things.
All right.
We've had her tested for all those allergies. She's allergic to trees, plants. She's allergic to wheat. So she is on a special diet.
Okay.
And
do you know what diet she's on?
She can't have anything with wheat in it or
okay.
chicken.
Okay.
So that kind of eliminates about 90% of the dog food that's out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, and the only way you can really truly test for food allergies is through elimination diet trial. If your veterinarian did a blood test to try to do a food allergy screen, not very predictive of what they're actually allergic to. Hmm. And your best bet is to still go through that 8 months of not even letting a Cheerio drop to the ground and just keep her on a very restricted diet of something that she's never been exposed to before. And that would probably, as you found out, exclude almost everything on the market.
Just one last question. You mentioned like the long-term use of steroids and how bad they can be for you, the mm-hmm. dog. Are there any tests that we should give her periodically just to make sure that they're not affecting any of her organs?
Yeah, the two big things that we can run into is chronic urinary tract infections without any symptoms. So having a sterile urine sample collected and having it cultured to rule out whether she's got a silent urinary tract infection. And you can also do some liver evaluations to see if you're causing her to run into troubles with Cushing's disease or if, you know, her adrenals are totally shut down, Addison's disease. So, but the big thing is urinary tract infections is something that we can see.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Pleased to have her along and thanks for listening in. Sandy, you know, we kind of thought that the food warnings about dogs were over, and here comes another one.
And, you know, this is where it pays to just keep checking websites once in a while. The website I would recommend is avma.org. Okay, that's the American Veterinary Medical Association.org. They will publish, and they really are careful about making sure they don't put any false claims out there that you may find on some other websites. But there's the new warning is regarding chicken jerky treats for dogs that are made in China. And you know what? I got this warning. I went into my cabinet, and I had just bought some, and they're in small print. China. So, $3 down the drain. And my dogs were like, don't throw them out. But, you know, it wasn't worth me even knowing. They don't have certain brands. They don't even know what brands they are because it's various brands. But that seems to be the connection. No deaths yet. But some of these dogs have required hospitalization and fluid management and so on. They typically will run into troubles with being, very lethargic and not wanting to eat and maybe start vomiting. If you're using these and, you know, your dog's been sick, stop using them. Go to your veterinarian. They want to do a little blood work. But keep watching that site. They'll probably keep some updates going.
So it's avma.org.
Yep.
.org. All right. Good advice. Let's go to Nick in Green Bay now. Hello, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hate to beat the subject, but I've got a 3-year-old black lab at home.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 years, he spent his life up in the UP, and he had a little bit of allergies. His eyes had a little bit of guck in it. And then we moved to Green Bay, and it's just a full-blown allergy attack. He, like, itches, and he got the guck in his eyes. And we went to the vet. They gave us something, and it kind of slowed it down, but nothing's ever really worked. They told us Benadryl. We give him Benadryl, and it's like we're giving him nothing. And
yeah,
it just drives us nuts because he itches and itches and itches. I mean, it's just a nonstop thing.
Yeah, and you know, and this is the problem, is there's no real cure for this. You can control them, but, if you really want the gold standard of therapy, you'd be going to a veterinarian that does skin testing, and you'd do some allergy testing, Or there is a blood test that you can do that, you know, may be a little less invasive for your dog and a little cheaper. So either visiting with a veterinary dermatologist or going back to your veterinarian to see if they can do some of this follow-up for you. If you're going to go and invest $100 or whatever it is to do the, it's about $100 to do the blood testing, there's a pre-test that you want to do that's just called an e-screen. It tells you whether the dog's going to test positive for something. And if that comes back negative, then there's no use sending the blood in for the full test. So you spend $25, do this pre-test, and then if it comes back positive, then you can send it in to do the full-blown test. Then, you know, the big things are, you know, controlling the dog's itching, either with, like, my dog right now is on some steroid eye ointment to keep his eyes from being inflamed. He gets steroid eardrops, and I'm using steroid spray on his feet because he's been licking his feet. So I'm just treating him kind of topically to get that under control. Back a couple of weeks ago, I just finished a course of antibiotics because he got a secondary bacterial infection. So far, no yeast infections. I haven't found any, but sometimes they have to go on antifungals as well. I mean, it's a matter of controlling the secondary infections, controlling the itching with various drugs. Antihistamines don't tend to work very well in dogs. So, you know, there's other things we can use. There's a new drug for dogs called Atopica, which is cyclosporine. Quite pricey for a dog like yours, but very effective if they can, their GI tract can tolerate it. It's just one of those things where labs are now becoming one of the top dogs that have this as a problem. And personally, as a veterinarian, I love the breed. I love Goldens. I love labs, but I see every day one of them come in. I wouldn't touch one with a 10-foot pole as a pet because of the allergy problems.
I got a quick question for you. I was talking to another lab owner. And she said that her veterinarian gave her dog a shot, and that cleared it right up.
It was probably a long-lasting steroid injection.
Okay.
And so the risk with that is that you can start causing some troubles with the adrenal glands and the liver and so on.
Okay.
So you just don't want to get hooked on, you know, if your dog is intensely itchy, short-term round of steroids may help take the edge off, but it's not going to be the cure for your dog.
Yeah, because I don't want to do anything negative to him. He's my baby. So.
Yeah. It might be time to talk about a visit to a veterinary dermatologist if you're, you know, finding that your dog's really miserable.
Yeah. Good luck. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks.
Nick, appreciate the call. And Tracy in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tracy.
Hello. I feel like the odd duck talking about my cat. I've got this cat. She's 10 years old. She's my baby. Can't do no wrong. But she gets a urinary tract every 3 months.
Okay.
And it's just been driving me absolutely bonkers.
Okay.
And
how long has this been going on?
This has been going on for the last year.
Okay. And it truly is an infection. Your veterinarian is culturing the urine and finding bacteria.
Yes.
Okay. This is the reason why I ask is that true urinary tract infections in cats, unless they are senior citizens with underlying health problems like kidney disease, diabetes, thyroid issues, it's really uncommon to see actual bacteria in the urine because cats produce such concentrated urine, it just prohibits bacteria from growing. In fact, one of the statistics that's been reported is that cats under 10, less than 2% of the cats with blood in the urine actually have a urinary tract infection. So that's why I was asking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if your cat does have a chronic urinary tract infection, make sure it's getting cultured, that it's being treated with the appropriate antibiotic. You have to rule out underlying causes such as a bladder stone. So if your veterinarian has not taken abdominal x-rays or done an ultrasound of your cat's bladder, it's time to do that. And I'd also be looking at, being a 10-year-old cat, what other medical problems could be there to cause your cat to have urinary tract infections. Is she concentrating her urine or does she have some early kidney disease? Is she hyperthyroid, which can cause her to have some urinary tract issues as well? Or is she a diabetic? So get some lab work done and try to get to the bottom of this. The most common reason why we see cats under 10 that have kind of the cyclical round of bloody urine is a problem called FIC, feline idiopathic cystitis. It's where they get inflammatory changes in their bladder, usually brought on by stress, and it's very common to come and go. And, you know, the cycle of it is such that you see the blood in the urine, you go to your vet, if they don't check a urine sample and they just say, here's some antibiotics, you put your cat on it, and guess what? 7 days later, the cat's better. And if you didn't put him on antibiotics, guess what? 7 days later, the cat's better. So you always want to go in and make sure that you do get a culture done to make sure that it's not this sterile cystitis problem.
The last time she was in, they did the whole nine yards. It cost me like $350, but they did an ultrasound. They ran every blood test you could run on the cat.
Good, good.
Pretty much, she's in excellent health.
Yeah, yeah.
For being a 10-year-old cat, they're just scratching their heads trying to figure out why she's constantly getting them.
And this may be something for your veterinarian to either send all their lab work and even their ultrasound results to get a second opinion, to see if there's something that they're missing. I do it all the time, you know, and sometimes it's right there underneath your nose and you miss it. And maybe considering getting a second opinion may not be a bad idea. And make sure that you are treating with the appropriate antibiotic long enough. Going back for a culture post-treatment is also important to make sure that you've cleaned everything up.
Good luck. Thanks, Tracy, for calling. Appreciate it very much. And Connie and Lena, it's your turn now. Hi, Connie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Anyway, I have a cat. He's only about a year old, a little tomcat, and we had him fixed and everything, but he was a barn cat, and he was so sick when we first got him, so we had to quarantine him because we have another house cat, and they're both indoor cats. Okay, so we quarantined him in the garage for, I'd say a good month. And we had him on antibiotics and vitamins and everything. We had him to three different vets. We brought him in the house. He was doing fine for a while, but he sneezes. He has a sneezing problem. And he slings out, this is so gross, he slings out this snot.
Yep.
I mean, just chunks.
Yeah.
And they're so gross and sticky that, I mean, I have a hard time keeping up cleaning after him.
Oh, yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, now, we had him in the house for almost a year. We think he's about a year old. And we had him to three different vets. We don't know what to do with him anymore. We had him on Clavamox, I don't know, probably about 4 or 5 times. And he seems to get a little better, and
yep.
then he gets right back into it. The last time we saw a vet was about a month ago, and they put him on prednisone. That didn't help.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not uncommon for cats that there's a few things that I think could be going on. And it may just be that your kitty, being a sick little barn cat, picked up herpes, which is cat rhinotracheitis, and now has chronic bone changes to the nose. You can have a severe enough respiratory infection that it can affect the turbinates of the nasal passages, those little fine bones that are in the nose that filter the air, and they can get, you know, just chronic infections because of the damage that's been done previously by a virus. And so it'll just keep, you treat them with antibiotics and it goes away and it comes right back again because the underlying cause is still there. The other thing that I worry about, he's a young cat, and we can sometimes see these, I already brought it up in the previously in the show, something called nasal pharyngeal polyps. It's actually a polyp in the back of the nose, sometimes in the throat, that can result in chronic upper respiratory problems as well. Sometimes foreign bodies can get up there. They've inhaled something, a grass on, something that can get stuck up there that can continue to cause problems too. If you really want the gold standard in therapy, what you would do is get a CT scan done of your cat's skull. Under general anesthesia, cats don't sit still in a CT unit. They have to be anesthetized. They would have a look at your cat's head and see where the problem is and see if they can identify what's going on. Then what they would do is, while your cat's under anesthesia, get in and look up from behind the back of the throat with a scope and see if they can see anything from behind, like a polyp that could be surgically removed. Going up the cat's nose with the rhinoscopy unit, they've got such tiny nostrils, it's really hard to do. Some cats benefit, though, when they're anesthetized, if they don't find anything physically wrong and it's just a real snotty nose, from sometimes therapeutic nasal flushing, where you just go in and just flush all the goobers out of the nose. And sometimes even then you'll get, you know, chunks of stuff that are diagnostic. I know it sounds gross, but that's kind of the gold standard of therapy. And you're looking at it being, you know, a pretty expensive proposition, CT scan, rhinoscopy, lab work. And I hope your cat has been checked for the diseases that suppress the immune system, like feline leukemia and FIV, because those would be a couple of diseases that can cause chronic infections as well. And if your cat hasn't been tested for those, it's time to get that done.
Good luck. Thanks, Connie, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And we had an email from a person who has an 18-year-old Westie. She has bad sight and flinches when there's a change in light, and wondered what are some things that she should be aware of in the dog's old age to keep the old timer comfortable.
Oh, you know, not rearranging your furniture for vision's impaired. She may be a little photophobic, meaning like light just bothers her. Have you ever been to the eye doctor, had those drops put in?
Yes.
Your pupils are dilated and you can't see real well. Well, many older dogs can have problems with their iris not working real well and their pupils are dilated, and so bright lights may bother her. Or if she's visually impaired, just has that startle response. So don't rearrange the furniture. Try to make a noise or something as you approach, rather than just reaching out and touching her. So again, you're giving her a chance to understand that you're there. Being her kind of seeing eye person when you're out with her, having her safely attached to a harness and leash, so that she knows that she's with somebody that's not going to let her trip over steps or any obstacles. And that's wonderful. 18 years old, boy, that's right up there.
Time.
And sounds like she's had a pretty really good life, and it's going to have enjoyed even more with a caring owner like that.
Scott in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if your guest could give me her opinion on an article I read in one of my hunting magazines. I have a couple hunting dogs, and they're in optimum condition. I train with them all summer long, and I keep them on a very high profile dog food for high-performance dogs. And
good.
This article claims that it's better to feed the dogs once a day in the evenings, and that they perform better the next day if they have close to 24 hours after their last feeding.
Ooh.
And I was always feeding the dogs once in the morning and once in the evening, and splitting their daily ration.
Yeah, I like to see dogs fed twice a day. I find that there's less bolting of the food. You don't have that big volume of food going down in there. What I'd be concerned about, though, is if you are feeding your dog and then taking them right out and exercising, especially with deep-chested dogs, you can run into troubles with gastric dilation and torsion with exercising after a heavy meal.
Great.
So, some of the pointers and the real setters and so on with the deep chests are more prone to that as a problem. So multiple feedings a day is better than one feeding. So two feedings a day would be better. I don't know how well the dog would perform 24 hours without food. I mean, I'd be...
That's awful.
Yeah, I think they need that energy, and I think they're going to perform better. So my opinion is continue what you're doing. Obviously, you're doing something right. Your dogs sound like they're in tip-top shape.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
doing everything fine. Can't always believe what's written.
Yep.
Well, what's your idea on some of these high-energy dog treats that are made to keep the dog's energy level up, and even some of these supplements you add to the water or something that is similar to like a Gatorade made for dogs?
Right. And they have these just kind of like power bars for people.
Right.
They have them
right.
for dogs now too. If you've got a dog that tends to start to get, pooped out, giving them some carbos, may help. It won't hurt them. It's worth trying. I think a lot of that's pretty gimmicky. It's kind of following in the human line, and that, if you, eat correctly before exercising, you probably don't need to be too worried about it.
Would it hurt to give dogs some of this regular Gatorade that has the low sugar content? Would there be any problem with
if they don't have any underlying heart or kidney disease, which if they're functioning dogs that are out in the field, hopefully
right.
they're not,
right.
that shouldn't cause any troubles at all.
Okay, great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott, for calling. And John in Fond du Lac, we'll turn to you now. Hi, John.
Yes, we're out here camping, and we have a 14-year-old Malamute, and she is exhibiting the symptoms that you described with the chicken things. And we have fed her the chicken things to, we pick them up from Sam's, and she's vomiting, and it's been 2 days now. Just taking some water. We're going to close up camp here shortly and head back home to our vet. But
Yep.
Could you re-describe those symptoms, please?
Okay. Well, this is what's reported here. These are typically, I'll read what's been written. These are typically small dogs, okay? So not Malamute size, but small dogs that present with a history of vomiting, lethargy, and anorexia, meaning not wanting to eat. And they've consumed jerky treats, mostly chicken jerky, within the last few weeks prior to becoming anorectic. Physical exams unremarkable. Blood chemistry can show some electrolyte imbalances, increased liver enzymes, and acidosis. And so it's very vague symptoms, and I think stopping feeding your dog, I mean, anytime you've got a dog that's vomiting, the best thing you can do is just give the stomach a rest and take the water and food away for a few hours. If everything stays down and they're not vomiting anymore, tiny amounts of water can be introduced maybe 12 hours later. If your dog's continuing to vomit, even on not getting anything orally, then it's time to, you know, get into a vet right away.
All right.
Well, yeah, she's got some of those symptoms, and so I think we'll just take her to the old doctor Ness and make sure she's okay, because she's been a good old gal for me for 14 years.
Right, and I know that Walmart has pulled these treats from the shelf, and if you bought them at Sam's, a lot of times they're similar products, just packaged, you know, bigger sizes from Walmart. So
they're the jerky, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate this program. It's a very nice thing that you're doing.
Thanks, John. Thanks a lot for calling, and good luck with your dog. And Carl in Madison, hi to you.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
I adopted two cats first week of May. One is 8 years old from one of two twins, and the other cat is a year and a half from the other of two twins. And my question is the following. The one that's a year and a half old was hit by a truck when he was about 3 or 4 months old. And it's difficult to explain, but his right paw sort of flops, and there is an operation where they can put a pin in there, but it's bloody expensive.
Uh-huh.
He walks on his forearm most of the time, but downstairs where the floors are very smooth, he'll sometimes just push on that.
Uh-huh.
Now, he runs. He's a terrorist. And,
okay.
He runs from the front of the house to the back of the house, down the stairs, around whatever, upstairs. And there's a cat tree, which a friend of mine gave me, with three steps on it. They go running up and down. The little guy can keep up with the older guy.
8-year-old, yeah, yeah.
Now, the question is the following. When I stroke his neck, and they're both purr balls, and they keep me awake at night with their purring, I run my hand down his neck, and his fingertips, he's scratching them, and on the side where the paw is
limp,
damaged,
yeah.
The right shoulder blade is very, very high, and the other one is not pronounced at all, whereas on the other cat...
You can, No, what I bet is what happened is your cat sounds like it's got nerve damage to that leg. If it's just, you know, flopping and you're actually able to feel the shoulder blade better, maybe that it's that muscles have atrophied over the shoulder. And this just gives you a good example of cats and dogs can get along great with three legs. They don't have the same social changes that we do when we undergo amputation. And your cat's adapted very well. And if it starts to get irritated from being rubbed, you may want to be looking at talking to your veterinarian about amputation. If I know that sounds extreme, but actually your cat's not using the leg right now, so it's probably, you know, won't miss it if it's gone.
Is there any way that you can think of where I could, I threw them treats down the stairs. That was the other question I wanted to ask. I think it's good that they stay exercised as much as possible.
Uh-huh.
So I have little treats I throw on, all kinds of toys, and they chase them and whatnot. But is there any way that I could give him more exercise that, or should I stay away from exercise him, like running up and down the
stairs? No, I think keeping the other three legs in good physical shape, because they need to be kept healthy, is a good idea. And it sounds like they're leading a great life. Just watch for any abrasions on the top of that foot if he's rubbing it, especially on the carpet. And if that happens, then it's something that's going to need to be taken care of.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good luck with your babies.
Good luck with the babies. And Sandy, wow, time is...
Yeah, an hour and a half. Whoa, went right by.
Flew by really quickly. And once again, we should probably remind people that if you want to check out food warnings, where do we go again for that information?
AVMA.org, which is the American Veterinary Medical Association's website. Great place to look for updated press releases.
And there's lots of other information on there as well for consumers. So
sure is. Yep.
great a great place to go. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We'll look forward to your next visit.
Okay.
Next month or so. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. She's a clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's always the case when Sandy's on. Our lines are always full right to the sweet. I should say the sweet end of the program, not the bitter end of the program. So glad to have her along, and she'll be back, and we'll do this again with her. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking with Rod Kroonen. Rod, of course, is Wisconsin's Commissioner of Railroads, and we'll be talking some rail safety issues with him. Been a few accidents, collisions with automobiles and other things as well, and there's plenty to talk with him about. And I'm sure he'll be answering your questions too. Stay with us for now, though. Lots of things in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.